Geekscapists, welcome to Geekscape. I'm your host, Heidi Cox. If this is your first time on Geekscape, if this is your first time listening to Geekscape, welcome. We like to talk about pop culture, music, video games, comic books, and we also like to talk to storytellers. Now, you might be wondering why I am here. Well, seems like Jonathan's a little sad about the delay of the Weezer album being dropped today, so I may have to take over for a little bit. I hope that's okay. We're also talking to my uncle, he's kind of responsible for my nerd education, at least my early nerd education. I think my very first D&D game was played with Uncle Henry. My uncle's name is Henry Vogel. He is the author of The Lost Planet and several other books, one of which I did the audio book recording for. And when I was little, he wrote a comic called The Southern Nights. If you've never read it, you should check it out. We also have someone who's a good friend of mine on later named Jack Seaford McDonald. And he co-starred with me in Chasing Fletcher Allen, which was co-produced with Geekscape by my company, Dweeb Darlings, another one you might want to check out. Jack is also co-starring right now in the Netflix series Never Have I Ever. So you should definitely go check that out. So anyway, this is my room. I don't know if y'all knew that, but we've been broadcasting from here for a while. You know, you can pretty much see, let's see, this is where I hang my stuff. This is a piece of art that was given to me by my friend Shayla. That's a picture of me and my grandmother, in case you've ever wondered what those things were. I don't know. So welcome to Geekscape. So let's see, feel free to comment if you want. This is all there is to this. This is really easy. I don't know.
Hey, what are you doing? What are you doing?
I just, you know, since you're using my room as studio space, I thought maybe I could take over for a little bit.
I wasn't gonna do a Geekscape today. I don't know. I was just gonna.
But we have my uncle on.
You have your. I wasn't prepared to broadcast at all. I'm sorry, guys. Mm. But I guess we have a show booked, so I will do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So wait. Run it past me. You've got sci-fi author Henry Vogel coming up.
Yes.
And then later on, our friend Jack Seaver McDonald is going to be on
from Netflix. You know, he played Orcon in Chasing Fletcher Allen, co-produced by Dweeb Darlings, my production company.
Okay.
So, there we go. It's the camera's backwards.
Yeah, anyway. So guys, Heidi kind of took over the show. Podcast listeners, don't feel ignored. This is Geekscape.
Welcome to Geekscape.
Yes, Heidi, you did very good in the intro.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just heard the show start, and I was in the other room, and I said, whoa, hey, no, ain't nobody taking over my ship. And
hey, Vaughn.
I said, no, now she's
Vaughn says, hey, Heidi, how is it going? It's going well, Vaughn. Thanks so much. Welcome to Geekscape. Any other Geekscapists out there want to say hi, feel free. Throw in some comments. I'm here.
Okay, Heidi.
I think I did a really good job.
You know, you're doing great. It's weird. Nobody else has ever hosted Geekscape in the 14 years that we've been doing it. So thank you.
Well, you're so welcome. You know, I just knew you were feeling a little down about the Weezer album.
they delayed it. Listen, I'm going to take back over the ship. Here we go. Give me those.
Okay, but I'm staying. So listen, you talk to my uncle.
Okay. Thank you. Heidi, let's not. Come on.
All right.
Here we go. Sorry about that, Geekscapist. I'm taking back control of the ship. Here we go. Got myself a pirate hat. And podcast listeners, Heidi ignored you guys, and you are my bread and butter. I love you, podcast listeners. This is now a visual medium as well, and Heidi thought it would be cool to take the show over since we are broadcasting out of her bedroom.
You are welcome.
But I'm going to go pirate style now and take back over my podcast. Whoa, I got to get the hat and the headphones to fit at once. Okay, I think I got it. I think I got it, Heidi.
You're going to wear the pirate hat. You know what I'm going for.
Whatever you want. Okay, so I got my pirate hat. I may not have the pirate hat. Here we go. Okay. Geekscapist, sorry about that one. Welcome to the show. Like Heidi said, we've got Henry Vogel on to talk about his sci-fi books. Let me see some of these. The new one that's come out is The Lost Planet, but I first found out about Henry's writing through Heidi, because Henry is Heidi's uncle. So Henry's going to join us here in a bit to talk about, I really want to talk about 80s comic creation, because he would write comics back during the 80s. And we're talking about like the era of like John Byrne writing all those classic like X-Men comics with like Christopher Claremont and all that stuff. Like that's classic stuff. And of course, like the great Teen Titans run of the early 80s and that kind of stuff. So we're going to get into that. And this is Geekscape. So Heidi, thank you. But
you are so welcome.
I am the captain now.
Yeah, but I'm also the queen. So.
Okay. Well, thank you, Heidi. Thank you.
Listen to y'all in the other room.
Okay. Thank you so much, Geekscape. This is Geekscape. I'm Jonathan London. If this is your first Geekscape, yes, like Heidi said, we're going to be talking pop culture, movies, some video games, some comics, and yeah, strap yourselves in. Let's welcome my first guest. This is Henry Vogel. Like I said, he's an author. He's got a couple books out now. You guys can find him on Amazon, but let's go straight to the source here and welcome Henry to the show. Henry, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How are you now that you've taken control back from Heidi?
I was usurped. It was insane. I was literally just like not even paying attention. I look up and Heidi had started this pirate broadcast of my own show. And I was like, no, not on my watch, sister. But the positive that comes out of it is that you are on the show. And I think that you're a pretty good booking. And I love talking to anybody who writes sci-fi and wrote comic books. They're perfect for Geekscape. So I've got you here on the show, man. How are you doing?
I am doing great. I'm on the East Coast, so I'm about as hi, Heidi. I'm waving back at you. I'll wave. See there.
She is so, nothing if not distracting.
Yeah, but I've known her.
A wonderful distraction.
Yeah, I've known her since she was born, as you might guess, being her uncle. So she's always been very, very good at being the center of attention and sort of taking control of things.
So Heidi said that you were kind of her intro to like the whole nerd universe, from Dungeons and Dragons to comic books to science fiction literature. You even had her do the audio book version of one of your books, the Counterfeit Captain.
The Counterfeit Captain. She did a great job too.
So like, what was it like? Talk to me about your history writing science fiction, because was I right in saying that when you were writing The Southern Nights, you were kind of, you know, an indie contemporary to that wave of comic creators, like I mentioned, like John Byrne, you know, Christopher Claremont, those guys. And that kind of leads into that mid-90s kind of, that mid-80s indie world where you get like Eastman and Laird making TMNT, and then you get the explosion of all those really great indie books. Can you talk to me about that? Because I've read The Southern Nights, and what's interesting to me is that back in like the early 80s, we have kind of like we have now. There's Marvel, there's DC. But then when you get past like the Image and the Dark Horses, you start to see these different imprints, and a lot of them are regionally based. What was your experience getting into comics?
Comics, it was – I actually got started – my whole writing career began as a comic book writer, and it came about because of sort of a lucky chance meeting in Clemson at Clemson University with a freshman who was named David Willis, who was my first partner with the comic book. And he was a huge fan, was forming a comic book club. And we were thinking, wouldn't it be great to write a comic book for the club, to do a club publication? And when I came up with the characters for the Southern Nights, I decided I don't want to actually turn them over to anybody except myself. And I had unmentioned here, I had actually had a little bit of previous publishing experience when a friend of mine and I co-edited and published a couple of issues, you can tell very short-lived issues of a magazine called Eternity Science Fiction. That one died on the vine, but I learned just enough about printing and publishing and what was required to be gutsy enough to think, oh, what the heck? If we had $2,000, I could, you know, we could definitely do a comic book. And David said, I have $2,000. yeah, seriously. You know.
Uh-oh. Oh, no. We've been down that.
Now to put things, I know. To put things further into perspective, is like you know, I was 24. I was going back to college. I had just gotten married. David was, when I met him, he hadn't quite turned 18. His birthday's in September, and he was a freshman. So I fully expected him to talk to his parents and say, I'm going to do this, and have them say, the hell you are. But right. They were incredibly supportive people. And we ended up going ahead with it. He was good friends with Sheldon Drum, who runs Heroes Aren't Hard to Find, Heroes Con in Charlotte. And he put us in touch with Butch Geis, who drew the first two issues. And once we got going from there, it was just a question of keeping things moving. We made just enough money off the first issue to print the next issue and on like that until we got through seven issues. And then David Anthony Kraft, former Marvel writer, editor, everything I think that you could do at Marvel, except maybe art, he did, had started up Comics Interview Publications, the Comics Interview magazine line, and he took over publishing from there. But yeah, our first issue came out in August of 82. So we were right there at the beginning. There were maybe two or three issues of ElfQuest out at the time, a couple of dozen of Cerebus. Those were big names at the time, and you may not have heard of them anymore because they were older.
I mean, what's funny is Dark Horse is still publishing brand new ElfQuest issues from Wendy and Peeny.
That's true. Dark Horse didn't exist yet.
Right. They didn't exist until 86, 87 when Mike Richardson started that up.
Right. We predated them. As a matter of fact, their very first comic book, Boris the Bear or something, he went around and shot everybody. He shot one of our characters from the X-Thieves. He shot Fred, the alien.
What's crazy is, I mean, you guys who are watching him maybe not as into comics as we are, you guys know Dark Horse because obviously off of that Dark Horse imprint, you had Hellboy, you have The Mask. You've got a lot of stuff that came off of Dark Horse, but it started kind of in this same sort of blood sport of indie publishing that the early to mid-80s was. Like you said, like Cerebus fought its way to, I think that was the first comic to hit 300 issues as an independent book.
Probably.
Yeah.
It's tough. When we published 34 issues of the Southern Knights, and we were one of the 10 longest running black and white independent titles at the time we finally gave up. The black and white industry, it sort of rose. It fell, and I can't find my camera. It rose, it fell, and then it rose again, riding on things like the Turtles, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Fish Police, a book that was hugely popular in the mid-80s, and I don't know that anybody these days has really heard of it. Cerebus rose up like that, and of course, ElfQuest was... Was building. All of those books started the build for the second and the really big black and white boom, which led inevitably, and I could talk for a long time about what caused the black and white bust, but basically it was every comic book shop was buying anything black and white that was a number one issue. We actually satirized that in X-Thieves issue number four. And they ended up getting dreck. They couldn't sell 12 for a dollar because people realized they didn't have to actually produce any artwork. They could get orders, they could do everything, put a crappy book out and make a whole lot of money and then sort of walk away. And they killed us when the stores decided that they were going to stop. They stopped every black and white book. They dropped us all.
And I think that the only thing that was like the remnant of that going into the 90s are pretty much known as like a dark period for comics because everyone wanted to get rich on the Mutant Ninja Turtles. And then you started to see these Marvel books make it to cartoons and you see the toy licensing when Toy Biz bought Marvel out of bankruptcy so that they could have IP for their action figures.
Right.
That kind of gave the new resurgence. And it's I mean, the story of selling the, I mean, we've had Kevin Eastman on the show, and the story of selling the Mutant Ninja Turtles is insane because they couldn't sell a cartoon without a toy agreement, and they couldn't sell a toy without a cartoon agreement. So they kind of like lied to the toy company and lied to the cartoon, saying the other one was in place, and they both went forward, and that deal could have fallen apart. We could have had no Ninja Turtles, which means no early comics movie boom of the early 90s, like the Dick Tracy, and then it turned into like the pulp stuff, like the Phantom. But post Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, when the kind of period we're talking about, when we start to see a lot of the black and white books dry up, and towards the mid to late 80s, there's really not a lot of stuff left beyond Jeff Smith's Bone, maybe, and Scholastic had a big part in helping that thing carry. And I think by the mid 90s, all we had was like, do you remember Poison Elves?
Like barely. Yeah, I do remember. I do remember that the title was out there. I probably have an issue somewhere in the back. Being somebody who did the black and white stuff, I did feel a bit of, you know, it's like if something looked remotely professional, I sort of felt obligated to try it out.
Yeah. Well, we got some questions here in the comments, Henry. Aaron Oliver off of YouTube says, hey, Henry, I'm interested in your writing process. How do you outline your books? Do you write every day? This is something that I've struggled with as well. Comic books to me feel like I'm shot listing and writing kind of at the same time. And what do you use? Sequence approach, or do you outline first and then go into the breaking down into the different, the different captions and boards?
Okay, so being kind of old school, I'm going to tell you the approach that I learned from my publisher, David Kraft, and also my editor, Dwight Zimmerman, who was working at Marvel at the time and sort of freelancing for us. We did a 22-page comic book. That was the standard then. I think it may still be the standard now. And effectively, what I did is I sat down with a piece of paper and I numbered lines 1 to 22. And on each line, I wrote a brief statement about what was going to happen on that page. It was one sentence that would sort of provide a page by page outline of what I expected the flow of the story to be. Once I had that, I went back, and this was back in the day when you had what was called the Marvel style of writing comic books, and there was the DC style. The DC style is called full script, and it's what virtually everybody does these days. But the Marvel style was to provide a description of the action where you broke each page down into a paragraph, and each panel was effectively a sentence in that paragraph. And you wrote the action. You didn't provide any dialogue. You might say, well, you know, this character says, you know, something about we're going to get you, or don't do that, or, you know, threatens, something like that, so that you could get the give the artist the proper information to draw the panel. But I would write that the total plot that I would send to the artist would be maybe 3 pages long. And the artists would work off of that, drawing the artwork. And as they finished pages of the artwork, usually going through entire scenes, they would mail those pages to me, and I would write the script based upon what was on the pages. That way I could, for instance, avoid describing what was happening in the art, and could play off of things that the artist introduced and make sure to include those into the script. I liked working that way. I've worked full script also, where you go and describe all the action panel by panel, provide all the captions and all the speech and thought bubbles. And that works out fine too. That was a bit of a shift for me. But now that I'm 15 books in on my novel writing career, I'm used to writing all the action and the dialogue at the same time.
Well, the full script one was that method was the one that when I was writing Miami Vice, I just had a lot of trouble with it. It did feel laborious. But I'd always heard of the Marvel method, and I think the control freak in me just didn't let me do it. But it was definitely something that I had heard about over and over again, because it was Stan's method. And obviously growing up, you think of Stan the Man Lee as being the, you know, the sale end all on comic book writing. And, and so the Marvel method was always something you aspire to. But for that, you're, I think that's the best approach, the way you talked about it, doing, breaking it down into pages. But then for me, I always remembered that you had to give a reason for the page turn. So it was almost like beyond breaking down the 22 pages, you had to economize where that right-hand page was going to be and make sure that you had something really pretty cool at the bottom right of it so that when they'd want to flip the page and see what happens, you know?
Well, that would have been a good idea. I never actually paid attention to that.
So. And, then you have them sell an ad and they put it on the page and they threw your numbering up and you have to change everything.
One thing you had to have with the Marvel style is you had to have a really good working relationship with your artist. You had to trust them. Mm-hmm. You had to trust them to put the information in there, put the stuff that you drew. And I only had one time where I had to go back to the artist where they took what I had written for an entire page and shoved it into one panel. And it was fortunately it was the very first panel in the page. So we just added a page to the comic book.
Well, Rick, though, off of YouTube says, when is the Southern Knights and Super Action Man crossover happening? Well, that's my character and Henry's characters, and we'll work on it. We'll work on something like that. Kuragari off of Twitch says, that's stupid. Good comics shouldn't suffer for overgeneralized garbage. That's clearly a problem with pre-internet data collection. Everything boils down to what's marketable and what sells now. So there's a limiting factor on what gets made now. I think that... It felt like a little bit more of a free-for-all back then in the early
80s. It really was.
The only distribution channel was like conventions, and you're almost selling zines at a certain point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there were half a dozen different comics distributors. Diamond was the largest of the bunch, and we sold more books to them than anybody else, but there were quite a few different comic book distributors. There was one called Glenwood, Capital City. There was Pacific Comics, short-lived. They were also known for their comics that they produced. But quite a few different distributors that we sold to. And it was a juggling act. But the problem was that this was still the early days of the comic book industry and the direct sales. And I think a lot of the guys running the comic book shops were comic fans first and businessmen about 33rd. Because we would hear from people, it's like, yeah, you know, we get your book, it sells okay. And you're like, well, you know, how many copies did you order? And I heard this story from more than one black and white publisher. They'd say, well, you know, we ordered 10 copies of the book. And how many do you have on? We don't have any. Did you reorder? Oh, look, we did. We ordered another 10 and they sold two. Apparently they did. Yeah. And what did, and we reordered again. You know, you'd find out they're sitting there thinking, well, we didn't sell much at all. And they sold 30 copies of the book.
And so given the data that wasn't working great. I mean, they had no real database,
no inventory control.
Right.
It was just sitting, they kept it up here. And, you know, God bless them because they, you know, I would have had no place to sell my comic books if there was not those guys. But they really didn't know the business side of things, or at least not the business side of things. They probably could have told you exactly how many copies of Amazing Spider-Man number, whichever they sold, because they were big Spider-Man fans. But maybe they weren't reading the Southern Knights or whatever. But there was a lot of misinformation flowing around. So they just, when they started finding themselves losing vast amounts of money on the crappy black and white books that were showing up, they just panicked. And as the, you know, the old saying goes, they threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
And we were one of the babies.
Well, Henry, why don't you talk about some of your prose work? You've got this new book, The Lost Planet. What's the story here? Is it in the same series as your previous work, The Fugitive Heir or The Counterfeit Captain? Or is this a series? Are you making your own shared universe, Marvel style?
I Well, the Fugitive Heir and the Counterfeit Captain share a universe. As a matter of fact, the main character in the Counterfeit Captain, Captain Nancy Martin, was introduced as a minor character in the Fugitive Heir. She really only appeared in a couple of scenes, but I just liked her as a character. And so I after I finished writing the Fugitive Heir, I ran with creating a story around her, the Counterfeit Captain, the idea being that that was an old science fiction trope of the lost generation ship that is vanished into space. No one knows where it is, and the people on board no longer know they're on board a spaceship. The difference is that I take somebody who knows they're on a spaceship and introduces them, and I introduce them into that culture, and then it's the adventure to see exactly what's happened, and can she get control of the ship and bring the help that these people need so that they can eventually actually settle on a real planet. But the Lost Planet, which, as you say, it came out in November, I kind of call that one my Star Wars, and it is in a totally different universe. There's no association with any of the other books. It features the two characters that you see on the cover. Yeah, these two. Yep. Basically the last hope for humanity when the vast alien empire called the Regency invades humanity, and they invade with, you know, they have 1,000 different species under their control in their empire, and humanity's got a handful, you know, a few dozen, maybe a couple of dozen planets that they've, so, you know, the Regency is invading with just a battle fleet that's larger than the entire fleet that humanity has available to them. And the reason that the two main characters, Glenn and Elise are their names, they are the last hope for humanity because they have a line on what they hope will be a weapon designed by an ancient, long-vanished race called the Progenitors, who raised all of the races in the Regency up to sentience from animals. They spent a lot of time, they raised all these people up, and then they vanished. They created effectively this massive empire, and then they vanished and left a servant race of theirs in charge. And the servant race runs things. They are, and they're the ones who they dislike humanity because they're kind of a heretic race, because the progenitors had nothing to do with humanity. And so they're out to bring them under the proper order.
So it is this, it's sort of a, you've got this dark horse kind of, the race that shouldn't even stand a chance against this much larger, superior technology and advanced civilization with so many more resources and control of the galaxy. They got one shot.
It's basically, sort
of
like, yes,
the Hail Mary story of can they overthrow, no, I'm not going to say evil empire, but this hegemony, right, of
yes,
and civilization.
And it's I don't want to try to give away too much because there is a certain level of discovery going in there as to what's behind it. And actually, humanity's level of technology is not that much lower than the Regency, the hegemony, as you were referring to it. But there are reasons for that, and they're described in the book. But the idea is that, yes, the two main characters and a few allies they have within the Regency have to push deeper into the Regency by themselves in a single spaceship to see if they can rediscover the lost homeworld of the progenitors. And they desperately hope find a weapon they can use to take back and stop the invasion of the human space.
And the eradication of the human race.
Not we would have been enslaved.
Oh, enslaved? Oh, no, that's not fun. I think I'd rather do the eradication thing. This is a one shot, or is this going to be?
It is all in one, all there. It's
all there.
Every one of my books is self-contained. Okay. If you read one, even the ones that are in a series, they do have a self-contained story. And if you decide you don't want to read any farther, you aren't going to sit there and go, like, oh, damn him and his cliffhanger endings. Every one of them is a self-contained ending.
That sounds like original Marvel in DC Comics.
Yes.
It's like the single issue stuff where if Spidey had to fight the Green Goblin, that's all you needed. And I think Joe Quesada said it best. I read an interview with him, and I remembered this a lot when I was writing, saying every comic is someone's first comic. So remember that when you're writing. Someone's going to pick it up, and it doesn't matter if it's issue one or issue 248. It's going to be someone's first comic, and you got to have a good story in and of itself in that issue.
That's right. And that's why you would always see Peter Parker would do the half Spider-Man, half Peter Parker thing. And somewhere in there, he'd always say, oh, I was supposed to go visit Aunt May and she's been so frail lately. All these things to give you the handy hints so that you would know who these people were. The first time you were picking up the comic book. And I try to make sure that whatever book you pick up of mine is, if it, you know, you'll have what you need to read it.
Well, Geeks gave us the book. It's called The Lost Planet. You guys can find it on Amazon. Just search for author Henry Vogel. I've got his name up here on the screen. Henry, thank you for coming on the show. Heidi just popped back in. Thanks. Geeks gave us, go find Henry on Twitter. He's HenryVogel9. You guys can find out about all his books. He's got a Facebook page. If you guys are watching this stream on Facebook, go search for author Henry Vogel. He's got all the information about not just The Lost Planet, but the rest of his books. And go pick them up on Amazon and order them. What else are you doing? We're in a pandemic. What else are you doing? You kick your feet up and read some books.
There you go.
Henry, thanks for coming on Geekscape, man.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Bye, Heidi.
Henry says bye. Heidi just dropped off this. What is this? This is a bill. Heidi, you just dropped this off. Why did you give me a bill? Studio rental.
Well, yeah. I mean, you are renting from Three Darlings. I was thinking maybe could you just wear that?
Can I wear that for the show? Okay. Like a place of this is sponsored advertising. Heidi, it's $1,000.
This is a Sweet Darling Studio space. So it's not personal, sweetie. It's just business. You know, I love you.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll talk about this. Okay. So.
Bye, Henry.
Okay. Heidi just came in and gave me a bill for the rental of her studio. That's great. And it's awesome to see that people are responding to me talking to Henry. Kurigari says, I just added it to my list to read. That sounds awesome. Let us know what you think, Kurigari. And again, he's HenryVogel9 on Twitter. You can let Henry know yourself. And Ricto says, speaking of indie publishers, I recently decided I want to read some old EC comics. Can anybody recommend specific titles from them? Let me bring Henry back in. Maybe he did. Hey, Henry, we got this guy wanting to read old EC comics. What any recommendations?
I hang my head in shame, but EC actually, even I'm old, but EC is older.
I was thinking, I was like, how are you going to define these? I mean, it's hard,
unless you go back to the 80s and you want EC to be Eclipse Comics, in which case I could make a recommendation or two. But I know he means EC Comics who were killed by the Comics Code.
And yeah, EC Comics did a lot of the horror comics and things like that. The crime comics, those were all killed by the Comics Code that only got thrown out like 10 years ago. But speaking of old Eclipse comics, I just read the Miracle Man series again, and that's some weird brainy stuff for you.
It really is. Very different. So I don't think you can go wrong with just about anything by EC. So I think you'll do fine. Look for names you know. Look for artists you know. Pretty sure Wally Wood did some work for EC, and he's an incredibly talented artist. Al Williamson probably did. All the big names. Frazetta may have even done some work for them. I'm not positive, but I don't think you can steer wrong. If it's still in print today, or if it's been gathered and reprinted, it's probably worth your while, because that's something that people are still interested in reading 60 and 70 years later.
Now, those are genre comics. Henry, thanks again for coming on the show. You got an encore, buddy. You got it.
Happy to be here. Thanks a lot. And Kurigari, thank you. I hope you enjoyed the book. And leave a review on Amazon, regardless of how what you think. I appreciate honest feedback.
Thanks so much, Henry. Cool. That was awesome. Henry, I hope that I see him again very soon. Okay, here we go. Have you guys been watching Netflix during this whole pandemic thing? Are you guys done with the Tiger King and the Love is Blind, all this stuff? There's a brand new series. It's on now. We got one of the stars of the show. He's actually a friend of ours. He was in Chasing Fletcher Allen, which was a Geekscape co-produced and Dweeb Darling's project. Thank you, Heidi, for reminding me that it was a Dweeb Darling's product. For another shout out so I can pay off the studio rental. I'll just keep shouting out Heidi's production company until I'm completely out of debt to her for using her bedroom to broadcast Geekscape. Our friend Jack Seaver McDonald is one of the stars, and we've got him right here. So if you guys are watching Netflix, you might just recognize this next face on the stream. What's up, Jack? How are you?
Hey, Jonathan. I'm good. How are you?
Jack, what's this show that you're on Netflix? Tell me about it. What's the name of it again?
It's called Never Have I Ever. And it's the story centers around Devi Vishwakumar, a 15-year-old Tamil Indian American high school girl from Sherman Oaks, California. And after a horrible freshman year, Devi wants to change her social status, but friends, family, and feelings do not make it easy for her.
Well, Jack, where are you quarantining right now? What's going on with you? Well, are you wearing a hat too? Like, I got this hat. Heidi says hi.
Hi, Heidi.
I've got a pirate hat on. What do you think of that? What do you got, like a safari hat?
Oh, no. This is a hat of my mother's. Yeah, I came in a little early and saw that you were wearing a hat. I wanted to wear a fun hat, too. So.
Does your mom know that you're wearing a hat?
Oh, yeah. I went and modeled before I came on.
Are you quarantining with your parents right now? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah.
Well, Jack, I mean, you're younger than me. You're a young kid. Now you're in this Netflix show. Why don't you tell me about it? Who do you play in this Never Would I Ever?
In Never Have I Ever, I play Eric Perkins, who is one of the classmates of Davey, played by Maitri. And I am in 5 of the 10 episodes. I have little bit parts here and there, and I'd say I'm pretty strictly comic relief at this point. Mm. But the rest of the show is also very funny.
You're nothing but like dramatic in Chasing Fletcher Allen.
Exactly. It's kind of a stretch for me doing something comedic, but I thought I'd give it a shot.
What I love, Jack, I would do this character. I just do it for my friends, and then I think we filmed it a few times, but it was my Dungeon Master character, Orcon. And mm-hmm. I did this character for my friends for like, I think I stopped doing Orcon maybe 15 years ago. And Orcon is one of these know-it-all kind of neckbeardy characters who's a DM and just he knows all of the Dungeon Master rules, right off the top of his head. Mm-hmm. A bit of a geek elitist. And that's a character that I would do just kind of to make my friends laugh. And we filmed it a few times. I don't think it's anything mm-hmm. that Geekscape has ever seen. And then when Heidi and I were writing Chasing Fletcher Allen, I wanted to put Orcon in there because mm-hmm. she thinks Orcon's hilarious. And she's like, you need to play Orcon, Jonathan. And I said, no, Heidi, Orcon is a younger character. Those days are past. And so we went in search of our Orcon, and you were our Orcon in Chasing Fletcher Allen. You had to actually grow the neck beard. How was that? I know you loved
it. Oh, yeah. It was fantastic. My girlfriend hated it, and it was very itchy, and it was my first time really, like, letting it grow out as much as I could. And I think it came out just about the way you guys probably wanted it to look. I remember you guys saying when you sent out the audition notice, you were like, yeah, he's a neckbeard. And everyone was like, oh, I don't have one, but I can grow it. And I remember weren't you guys saying, like, we don't really need the actual beard. It's the attitude behind the beard. and you guys decided to let me know I didn't need the beard, I think, after filming.
Well, here's the thing, is we described the character as a neckbeard type character, and honestly, in the auditions, you came in, and I was like, yeah, this guy's seen the subreddit. He knows what's up. He practiced with a katana sword or two in preparation for this audition. You came in and you were basically the guy. And then you start. Then we didn't shoot for another couple months. And by that time, like, you grew it. Mm-hmm. Don't blame me, brother. I don't blame me. You were doing some Al Pacino method crap. Where you were like, you know what? I have to become the neck beard. So no one told you to grow a neck beard. You inhabit the character fully. And I mean, would we have done that with makeup? Yeah, it would have looked like we strapped pubes to your face. But, you know, like, come on.
Yeah. No, it definitely helped having the beard. I really did feel the, you know, the sort of, low self-esteem, the hurt that is within all neck beards, I think.
The elitism of it. One thing that I've noticed with actors, and this is something that I think every actor has kind of their reset for a character. And when you guys see me, I'm not a very good actor, but whenever you see me do characters on Geekscape, are they characters or are they actual people? I've got these. I got certain phrases or lines that are resets. When I first moved to LA, I was an assistant on a Tom Selleck movie, and Tom Selleck would do mustache acting. And mustache acting is he has a mustache, and whenever he was supposed to look like he was playing a detective, and whenever he was supposed to look like he was thinking or, you know, investigating the scene of the crime, he would just peer off screen. Just at an angle, and he would just play with his mustache, like, right? It's almost like a bodybuilder, like an old villain twirling a mustache.
Yeah.
Now you had a character reset where you would just stroke your like neck beard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That helped you center the character. Is that the phrase? I'm not a thespian.
It sort of just helped remind me. What I was doing, and it actually was mostly just itchy. I was just scratching a lot of the time, but yeah, it was also a good reset to be just like, oh, Orkan ponders and wants people to know he's thinking hard. So
he's smarter than them. He's their mental superior. The good news is you grew it. So as Karagari states, I didn't have to yell on set, hey, somebody get me some more of that pube glue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would not have had you use pubes for the neck beard. We would have used something like, I would have found an animal and like shaved it or something. You could have had like shaved squirrel hair on your face or something. I'm nothing if not resourceful, Jack. How do you enjoy being part of a short film that has been finished just in time to run headfirst into the cancellation of festival season?
Oh man, I mean, is kind of one of my first short films in general, so it's as far as I know, this is how it always goes. But it was still like so much fun, and getting to see the finished product at a private screening was very fun. And
well, Jack, maybe one day somebody else will watch the movie. We can't show people the finished film because it'll make us ineligible for premieres at festivals, but at the same time, festivals like aren't happening, they're all postponing or they're doing this thing where they're going online and they're like, hey, we're doing an online festival. Do you want to take part in it? And I'm thinking to myself, well, if we take part in the online version of the festival, does that mean we can't screen in a real world festival like later in the year when people start going back to theaters or 2021? Like, I mean, I want people to see the movie as much as anybody, but at the end of the day, we did make a festival, a film that we wanted to see in a theater with people, because watching it with the cast and crew, that made it so much better after like months of doubting and not knowing what we have as a short. Have you guys laughing and responding? Oh,
Thanks, man. Heidi just chimed in. She said, stop. Oh, here it is. She said, stop saying pubes. Oh, yeah. I guess I just said pubes again. All right. That's what you get for throwing that comment. You can't. Listen, I'm the captain now. You can't come in here and shadow dictate the show when I've got the captain hat. This is my pirate hat that I will fit awkwardly onto my headphones. And if you know, I'm gonna say what we're gonna say. This is Geekscape, all right? You may have started the show, but you know I'm gonna end it. Kurigari, I was wondering when I was gonna get to see Chasing Fletcher Allen because I already paid for my digital ticket when he helped fund it. Yeah. No, listen, we're working on it, Kurigari. But festivals come first, and right now there are no festivals. Bandu, I wish we were part of a streaming series like you are. How'd you get involved with this thing, this Netflix series?
It was just one of the auditions that I got from my agent. And at the time, it was untitled. And I think I had another audition that seemed bigger, which is just kind of the way it goes. You know, you're auditioning and you're worrying about this one that seems really big, and so you seemingly aren't as worried about a smaller part or what have you. And I ended up getting this part, which was originally just a one episode, one scene character, and I just was improvising on set and having a lot of fun with the lines and the character, and they ended up inviting me back.
You know, who's the guy from American Pie that was like a one scene? You always hear these stories like somebody coming in and doing like one scene, and they end up like now being a bigger part of like the sequels or the next season or something. You know what I mean? Like, they started out and they were only supposed to be in one scene or a small bit part of the film, or they're only going to do one episode of that first season. But now, are you getting feedback? I mean, the show's been out like, what, a week?
Yeah, it's been out about a week, a little over a week, I think.
What's the response been to this Never Have I Ever?
People seem to really love it. It was number one on Netflix sometime last week. And then I saw one of the other cast members posted a picture that it was number one in like 7 or 8 other countries. And so it's been really impactful, I'd say, to a lot of people. And
now, Jack, have you gotten any like fan email, anybody hitting you up, anybody being like, hey, my favorite character is Jack's character?
Yeah, I've been getting some Instagram message requests of people being very kind and saying that, you know, they love the character, they thought I was funny, and all very kind messages. I'm very fortunate not to have gotten anything creepy. So
not like me threatening to like glue cat hair to your face or anything like that. Nothing than that level, right?
No, nothing compares to you, Jonathan. But overall, it's just been, yeah, a lot of positive feedback. One thing that I've been hearing from a couple people every once in a while is that it seems as though my character is kind of treated like kind of a fat joke, just because, I mean, I'm overweight. And
no,
so I played.
You're beautiful. You're beautiful.
Thank you, but they're not mutually exclusive. You can be overweight and beautiful. I know.
You're right.
Not a big thing, but anyway. And so some people have like complained a little bit about that and wondering if there's going to be more backstory to the character later, if there is another season. And unfortunately, I have no idea. I don't know what the writers are thinking. I don't know if there is going to be a season two, but. I think that the character is mostly misunderstood.
Yeah, here's the thing. I hope that there is another season. I hope that there's a lot more seasons, and I hope that they expand your character. I have not watched the show yet. I chose to watch Chris Hemsworth beat up a bunch of people in Extraction. Have you seen the Chris Hemsworth thing, Extraction, on Netflix? There's a scene where he whips a bunch of, like, there's a bunch of like 8-year-olds who attack him with machetes, and he just starts beating up a bunch of 8-year-olds. I was like, I don't really fucking know what is happening, but Chris Hemsworth is beating up a bunch of 8-year-olds with machetes. I think it's kind of tight. it doesn't take a lot for me, so I'll probably watch Never Have I Ever, and I'll probably end up like thinking it's the greatest thing ever, and it might. I'm sure it's amazing. It just, when it came down to Friday night and I was like, what am I going to watch on Netflix? I said, I want to watch Chris Hemsworth punch a bunch of 8-year-olds with machetes, fight them all at once. It's like that, you know, that website, how many 8-year-olds can you fight at once? Have you ever seen that website?
I have not seen that website. No.
Because you're a good person. Okay, Jack, don't, you should stop associating with me. All right. But I will tell you this, if we do end up going to festivals, when festivals return, and we end up, people, Heidi has said, we love the short, but Heidi's like, oh my God, after Stock and LeVar, and then this, I've done a lot of Heidi playing Heidi. She wants to play other roles. She doesn't know how to, she wants to expand that story. And I said, that's easy. We're going to do an Orcon series. So I may ask you to grow back the neck beard. Would you be willing to do that? What kind of price are we talking here for you to grow back the neck beard? I'm already in debt to Heidi for her studio rental. Like, talk to me.
Right. Yeah. it's just the love of the craft, Jonathan. If it's consistent work, a whole series, I'll consider it for sure.
Okay. We might see Jack as Orcon again. Well, you guys haven't seen Jack as Orcon the first time, but we're working on it. Kuragari says, as a fat guy, but yeah, I know how it feels to see fat people as only comedic relief and not something more. I think this guy, what's the name of this actor? He was in the Atlanta bombing movie for Clint Eastwood. He's a fantastic actor. He was nominated for an Oscar for the Tonya Harding movie with Margot Robbie. He's awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't think that he is a bigger guy. And I don't think that his appeal is all about, hey, he's a big guy and it's comedic relief. He's done some incredibly awesome dramatic stuff. He's a fantastic actor. Did you know that I listened to that guy was working at the Five Guys on Ventura in Studio City right up until he got the phone call that Kingdom was going to go, that he got the audition, they got the part in Kingdom, which is like one of these AT&T, like, on-demand shows. Mm-hmm. Paul Walter Howard is who we're talking about. Thank you, Derek. And I don't think that, obviously he's funny, but awkwardly, it's a different kind of funny. It's not, this is what I'm trying to say, it's not Paul Blart, you know what I mean? It's not
Paul stuff. I'd say, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You're the guy who knows stuff.
I was just going to say that it can be difficult to sort of parse that out when an overweight person is being funny. It's, I guess sometimes people just automatically are sort of like feel bad for them because they think it's only because they're overweight that they're funny or that that's what the joke is, but I know that there are plenty of, like, Chris Farley. He was overweight, but it was not often that I remember that the whole joke every time was, I'm big Chris Farley. It was his intensity, it was his commitment, and it's just interesting that, like, some people can see something like Never Have I Ever and kind of feel bad for my character because I'm overweight and I'm being funny, but I haven't had a bigger part in the show or something.
Do you think that that was what the material, that was the extent of the material for the show?
No, I really don't, especially since, I was only supposed to be there for the one day, and the first scene that I filmed, which is in episode 2, It's never mentioned my weight. I just am complaining about it smelling like shit in the room. And the teacher's like, Eric, just stop. It does not smell like that. And I'm like, yeah, it does. And so, you know, my character is like, he's sick a lot. He's difficult with teachers. The other students don't really like him just because he makes class difficult and a hard time. But he has, I think, a lot going on behind the scenes and his sort of backstory, which is waiting to be told.
Well, how close was it? Because you're not that far removed from high school yourself. You're a young man. You got your future in front of you, not like me. How was it playing someone in high school, which is probably not that distant of a memory to you now? Like, what was it like? Was it tough to tap back into it? Did he give you nightmares? What was the story there?
No, it wasn't super difficult, probably just because, yeah, I'm still pretty close to that. But also that sort of high school vibe doesn't really change much. I've experienced, as you go through life, people are still mostly worried about how they are being perceived. Like in high school, people are wanting to be cool. They want to be accepted. And it's something that can feel like a high school thing, but is true for any age, really. So it was really just feeling human. And
I think you just described Instagram.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's like people want to be cool. They want to show their best side. Everybody wants to be popular. There's a lot of pressure to fit it. Oh, yeah, it's just Instagram, Jack. That's like high school doesn't end. It just goes to Instagram. Like that's all it is. You just described social media. And it is actually crazy because I did go to high school at a time of no social media. And those were like my singular goals were, hey, can you get a girlfriend? Can you appeal to this group of people? Can you fit in here? And then when social media started kind of creeping up, I can only imagine how that compounded and multiplied those pressures on somebody actually in high school. Because it seems like, oh, I don't just have to compete for the 8 to 10 hours that I'm in school a day. This follows me home and it's on weekends. And this pressure is kind of really the eyes that are on me. There's no relenting of that. Was that the right kind of attitude when you went to high school? You had that stuff in high school. Like once you walk out of school, like I felt like once I left school and made it to the car, like those pressures disappeared. I knew I wasn't going to get beat up. No one was going to say anything rude to me. I was going to go home and I could chill and then prep myself for like the constant derision the next morning. It felt like a gauntlet, but a survivable gauntlet because it was only for like a few, it was only for like 10 hours. Now that gauntlet continues, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of right on the edge. I graduated high school right before it was really such a huge thing to have your social media on and popular all the time. So I also had that sort of relaxation of finally getting home and having to, prepare for the next day of war that is high school.
I gotta tell you, Rick, though, from YouTube says, this guy has a real hack commitment. You're going places. Jack, I think you are going places. I'm going to watch this thing. All right, I'm going to watch Never Have I Ever. It's on Netflix. It's 10 episodes?
Yep, it's 10 episodes, about 20 to 25 minutes each episode.
Oh, that's great. And there's you can finish it in 5 hours. It's
10
episodes. I can do, wait, hold on. I can do the math. Carry the one. Divide by, hold on. I can do the... Yeah. 5 hours of content right there. And I can do the math. You're in half the episodes. I can do this. You're in 2.5 hours worth of content. So if you guys just want to watch Jack, it's a 2.5 hour commitment. But if you want to get context to what his character is going through, you're going to have to invest in 5 hours of streaming content. Or we can do what I did last Friday. Is just watch Extraction with Chris Hemsworth and watch him beat up a bunch of 8-year-olds who are flinging machetes at him.
It's really just what you're in the mood for.
I think we should go with Jack in Never Have I Ever. It's currently on Netflix. You know what? It's probably always going to be on Netflix because you're on Netflix. I don't know how you get off of Netflix unless you're like Marvel. But
right.
Netflix made it. It's on Netflix. Never Have I Ever. Look for Jack. He's awesome. And then sometime in the next 10 years when festivals return, maybe you'll see Jack chasing Fletcher Allen, the Geekscape co-produced, Dweeb Darlings co-produced production that some of you guys helped raise the funds for and put together. Jack, dude, thank you so much for coming on Geekscape. Is there anything else you want to plug? Anything else?
I am without an agent right now. If you're an agency looking for more people, hit me up.
There we go. Maybe I'll represent you. How are you doing with contracts? Because I got an offer sheet. I got an offer sheet yesterday for something, and I need somebody to look at it. Could you be my lawyer and manager if I do some of your representation? Would that work, Jack?
Yeah. I think that'll be just fine. I doubt anything will go wrong. And
I'll send you the contract I just got. And then what I'll do is I'll send you out on like Actors Access and stuff like that and be like, hey, this is Jack. He acted for me. He's willing to grow a beard. You do not have to use pube glue to put cat hair on his face.
Does that work? Perfect.
Okay.
That's
all right.
Beautiful.
All right. Well, thanks, Jack, for coming on Geekscape. Jack McDonald, watch him
thanks
on
for having me.
Have I Ever on Netflix. Now, Geekscapists, I think that's our show. I love you guys so much. Hope you guys are doing well through this pandemic. I have had my bouts recently of, oh my God, this is going to go on for a while and our world is changing. And you know what? I think our world's constantly changing. We have to keep wrapping our heads around it, but the isolation fatigue does get pretty rough. And I'm somebody who I have been experiencing it. I started Geekscape all those years ago as a way to reach out to you guys. I couldn't get like arrested as a director. Now I can barely get arrested as a director and a storyteller, but I started Geekscape as a way to connect a whole community together, and now we've got you guys. And it really, really, really has helped me a lot to be able to go online and stream with you guys, keep making podcasts for you guys. If you are not a podcast subscriber, definitely jump on that, because I'm putting out audio interviews with people that are not making it to the stream. These are things that are not video, they're audio only, and they're available on the podcast. So go and subscribe to the podcast. And if you're a podcast listener who are like, hey, what's going on with all those visual jokes? And what was up with Heidi starting the show off today? And that sounded seemed pretty funny. Well, jump on and get on it, because we're on YouTube and Twitch and Periscope. I know you love the Periscope. And of course, Facebook. So come be a part of Geekscape on that stuff. It really has helped get me through this pandemic. And I hope that I'm able to give you guys a little bit of relief throughout your weeks. Because I think we're in this, but we're also in this together. And even though we can't like hug each other or meet up at Comic Con, we got this, and it's kind of the best I can do right now. And it's working for me, and I love it. And I'm not going to say that things aren't rough and that I haven't had dreams that I got COVID and turned into a giant beetle. That metamorphosis dream definitely happened to me last week. It was pretty freaking scary. Never went back to sleep after that one, but we are here for each other, and we did build Geekscape as a place for you guys to share and relate and talk about the lighter stuff, the fun stuff, the pop culture, and also talk about the personal stuff, the things we're going through. And I know that we're all going through something right now. Kurigari, you've been great this show. You said, thanks, Jonathan. I'm a little depressed, but I'm surviving. I still have a job. I'm getting by. Being single in isolation really sucks. Kurigari, dude, my heart goes out to you, man. I can only imagine. But look at the brighter side. You could be with somebody in the quarantine, and they could throw you a bill of $1,000 for live streaming the show from their bedroom. So I got to go figure out how to pay this bill. Maybe I'll throw you guys up like a kick. You know, maybe I'll be like, GoFundMe, how to pay for the Geekscape studio that Heidi is making me pay for now that I'm broadcasting out of her bedroom. But we'll see. Speaking of that, we're going to start up a stream tomorrow. If you guys are podcast listeners, you're not going to be able to see this, but on Thursday, you guys saw Heidi's haircut last week. That went pretty well. My haircut's not too bad, but please don't look at the back. She's not so good with the shaver. Tomorrow, I think it's time to pay the fiddler. I'm going to put on Heidi's makeup and give her a new hairdo. So if you guys like watching these streams, tomorrow, I'm going to be doing Heidi's makeup. I'm nothing if not an artist. but I've never done anybody's makeup in my life. So we're going to be doing that on the stream tomorrow. Follow our socials for all of that information. I think it'll be same bat time, same bat channel. Okay. So subscribe, share, all that stuff. I love you guys so much. This is Jonathan, Geekscape forever, and peace.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.